You are listening to a sermon by Johannes Stoltz, recorded on Sunday, October 6, 2013, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
First of all, I must say I enjoyed the singing.
Just the piano and the voices and the harmony.
Beautiful.
Unfortunately, we don't hear that often these days in our churches. Sometimes we do, and then I rejoice, like today. I'm very keenly aware of the fact that my wife has not accompanied me, or vice versa. I haven't accompanied her here. And I want to say greetings from her. She made sure I should extend these. And I explained to Erna that she had to play cello. She agreed to do that before she knew I was supposed to be here. So we went separate ways. So what God has joined together, the ministry temporarily separates. I want to start with a question. Profoundly aware that you folks live close to the university here with your church. I mean, you don't live, but you are situated close to the university. Is there a difference between a sermon and a lecture, a Christian lecture? And what would it be? Can I have some suggestions or some ideas? Thank you.
A lecture passes information. A sermon enhances the spirit.
Very good. Any other ideas? Any other comments? Not saying this is wrong, just to hear how you perceive it.
Well, maybe the location. One is given in a church, one is given in the university.
I agree to this. Yeah. It's quite often. Now, does that mean we never have a lecture in the church? Probably not, right? Yes?
Lecture, I think, comes from the Latin reading, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And now, I need some help with sermon. I don't know who knows Latin here, but I don't know what the root word for sermon would be.
What are the Latin scholars?
In Europe, unfortunately.
In Europe, okay. Well, excuse them. Yeah, I wouldn't be able to help you. Sorry. I would like to come back with the first suggestion. The lecture tends to address our intellect, right? Sometimes we also get emotionally involved, and what we hear presented is not necessarily what is up our alley. Is that correct? It can disturb us, as he said in the deduction, right? Did you notice that?
Sometimes
yes.
People use the word he's sermonizing.
Uh-huh.
So that has some context. That means there is a message that you're supposed to get.
I find it interesting, you know, sermon preaching, whatever, that at times people say, don't preach at me. Have you heard that before?
Yeah.
So obviously we are expecting, or we're implying, preaching is, in a sense, more deliberately giving an opinion, an orientation, whatever you want to call this, right? Whereas the lecture is a bit more open to, you know, what do you do with it? It's a more neutral presentation. I'm not sure can I say it that way, but I just wanted to clarify that at the beginning. This is not going to be a lecture. I don't want to pretend to be totally neutral, as some of the academics try to do still at the university, as if somebody can be totally objective. I think total objectivity eludes us on this earth. I'm not sure whether you're with me, but... So this is not objective, in a sense. And yet, I'm deeply convinced that from the source of the one who inspired this book, who is truly objective. Okay? Now, coming to this text which we have read, and I find that wonderful that we had that already read as an introduction. You might probably wonder what I want to choose as three keywords, which people, as I suggest, either love or hate. The first keyword I call a trap.
The text is a familiar one, especially that quote, "Give to Caesar, the Caesar's gift to God, that is God." It's even, I would say, part of a public discourse, right? I mean, you know, it's assumed people know what we mean with this kind of thing. Now, the context is important to consider. The Pharisees, the ones who were so critical of Jesus, very antagonistic from almost the beginning, I claim. They had plans, it says here, to trap him. The keyword, trap. Now, they don't do it themselves. They sent their disciples, the ones they taught in their legalistic approach. We've talked about legalism. And with their disciples, also the Herodians, which is not insignificant. I trust that we are aware that these are actually two parties with opposite understandings, right? The Pharisees were more upset with the Roman occupation, and so were their disciples, right? Whereas the Herodians were more in line with, right, the government which was instituted by the Romans. So these two opposite groups, were sent to Jesus. A trap, they are supposed to set. Now, that word trap, what was the trigger in our minds? Canadians used to be known for trapping, right? I think it was a few years ago that in Europe there were big protests against this inhumane practice of trapping. Are you still remembering that?
Mm-hmm.
Trappers love traps. Yeah, they want their fur. And so they don't blow these animals to pieces. They want to trap them and then, you know, use the fur. So animal rights activists, they hate these traps. And, you know, I can see this sometimes very, very cruel, some of it. I'm not here to advocate for a legitimacy of trap or not. I want to talk another trap, or hint at another trap. If you're a golfer, you know about sand traps. You'll probably hate them when you hit one in there, right? But if one of your buddies who you're, you know, competing with hits a sand trap, you're probably very glad there was one, right, that you hit. Isn't it true? Then it's a bit this, you know, go like this. Traps, some love them, some hate them. On this biblical occasion, or in this occasion here, the trap which these followers or disciples of the Pharisees and the Herodians were supposed to set is fascinating somehow. In order for a trap to work, you need what? A bait. Correct? Here in this text, I suggest to you, the bait is flattery. Flattery. Listen to these guys before they come actually up with the question. "Teacher," they said, "we know you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are." I suggest it is flattery. For a trap to work, you need a bait. And these folks were hoping that Jesus would be so enthralled with this flattery that he wouldn't be aware of what's coming. The intro to this question. It's fascinating. In the Old Testament, in Daniel 6, you know this chapter. It's Daniel in the lion's den, ultimately. Those people who come to Darius, they first do in a similar way, use flattery. And this guy, totally almost drunk with this flattery, issues a decree which he later deeply regrets. And he finds himself in this cage, in which he had stumbled into. I'm amazed that Jesus right away notices this question is somehow, or that flattery is something where you need to watch the question, right? He was aware of what's coming. So the first thing I suggest about this trap is that the bait is something we could learn from, to be aware of flattery. Not always, but usually, there can be something to watch out for coming. Yeah. Then I learned from Jesus also not to answer right away, right? He poses another question. He counters, you could say, with a question. And I would even, I tend to see it as there's an either-or mentality at work here. These Pharisees sent their disciples and the Herodians with this question which seemed to say, either it is right to pay taxes or not. You know? Either or. So the either or mentality, you could say, is almost the cage. You have the bait, the flattery, and now is this cage, right? But Jesus counters with this profound question. He says, when they give him that coin, right? Whose image is on there? And he does it because he is aware this is not an honest question. You know, this is not coming from a true desire to have an answer. It is a trap. And so he even says, you hypocrites! That's pretty strong language, right? You could say judgmental, right? But he uncovers the true motives. He says, you're actually putting me here in a position where you give a trick question. It's not an honest question. You're not looking for an honest answer, but you're looking for me to put my foot in my mouth. That's what they're doing, right? So he demasks, in a sense, what is going on here. The trap for Jesus was clearly visible, and he was not willing to go into it. First keyword is the trap. Second keyword, now I call the tax. The question was, is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or to the emperor, as the translation says, which we read? And again, isn't that something we either love or hate? Mostly hate, I guess. It depends. There's some who are more on the left side, you would say, no, I love taxes. I get services out of it. And that is very legit. But I just remember hearing in BC, what is it, a year ago, this whole issue about the HST, right? You heard we run a bed and breakfast. And my wife actually said, I love this tax. It simplifies my whole thing, you know, keeping the books off this B&B. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's strange. You know, some people, some businessmen, they liked it, and others hated it. The enemies of Jesus were sure with these questions we can nail him. With this question he will be going down. If he answered yes, then he would be, you know, siding with the Romans. And the Pharisees, the disciples, they could denounce him as helping the oppressors, right? The Romans, the occupiers. If he said no, then the Herodians would say, ha ha, we got you. You're a rebel, you know, a revolutionary. So either or, he would be in trouble. That's what they had hoped. That's why they sent both extremes, disciples of theirs and the Herodians to him. Now, in asking for the coin, Jesus in response says, give me a coin. He points out something which I think is quite fascinating. He says, whose image is on there? In the Greek, it's not so much the word picture or whatever, it's image. And you can look up some other references where this word is translated as image. It's important that we get this. You will find that out later. But in a sense, Jesus says, you have to admit it is Caesar on here, right? Now give to this person, this image,
Jesus. Give him what belongs to him. And I think we need to understand here, it is as if Jesus makes them admit the reality of the Roman occupation. You see? Why? The Pharisees, as I see it, were living in a denial in a sense. If you have your Bibles, or if you're going to go with me there, in John chapter 8, verse 33, is one of these other dialogues, discussions, or whatever you call it, where Jesus and the Pharisees are going at it. And Jesus says there, you know, if you hold to my teachings, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. You've heard that verse. Now get the next verse. They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants. We have never been slaves to anyone. How can you say we shall be set free?" They were in denial of the fact that they were occupied by Rome. "We have always been free. What are you talking about?" No, they were not free. So in a sense, Jesus here gets them, or tries to help them, to become honest with the situation, with themselves. In effect, Jesus is telling them, as long as you use Caesar's money, and so benefit from his rule, so long you owe him taxes. They were using the Roman roads. They were, right? There was a certain benefit they had from this occupier. You might wonder why I stress that. I think there's a timely reminder for us that our taxes are not a gift to the government, but what we owe it for its services rendered. Right? That's a good reminder for us. We might think we do not always get a good bang for the buck, but that's another discussion, right? Jesus, in his answer, also indicates, and that is now the second thing, that the state is not to encroach on God's domain. Caesar oversteps his boundaries when he demands something which only belongs to God. Give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, but not everything belongs to Caesar. Give to God what belongs to God. To God belongs homage, worship, blind loyalty if you want, but not to Caesar. To God. This is a very important principle. And I want to insert a little personal background here. I come from Switzerland, and in Switzerland at that time when I grew up, they still had the military service. In a sense, every young man had to go to the military when he was 18, 19. And then they keep on going every second year, a repetition course to stay in shape and stuff like that. I had just accepted Christ in a very personal way, committed my life to his Lordship when I was 18. So when I was 18 and a half, going 19, I got the conscription or whatever you call it. The problem was, I started to read the Bible after I accepted Christ and came across Matthew 5. I started the New Testament, and Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says, you should love your enemies. And right away, that dawned on me. When I now accepted Christ and want to live for him, with him, under his guidance, I can't go to the military and learn to shoot, you know, people. This is contradictory. My dad was a Christian too and had gone to the military, and so I started to ask him, how could you go to military when Jesus clearly says this? He says, oh, yeah, but the Bible somewhere else says you have to be submissive to government. And I was very naive, totally young in my life as Christ. I said, yeah, but if the government says something which is different than what Jesus says, I have to obey Jesus. He says, yeah, they can't do that. Just imagine it. Everybody in Switzerland would do that. We would have chaos. And I said, Dad, yeah, but not everybody is a true disciple of Christ in Switzerland. So there's no chaos when I don't do this. Ah, you obey your light, which you have some scripture. I obey my light. That's how we agree to disagree, right? Now, I prayed very naively before I had to go and be mustered or whatever, you know, check you out whether you're fit.
I said, Lord, you can help that I'm not fit.
What a stupid prayer, right?
But in my naivety, I said, okay, Lord, you get me off the hook here. Well, they chased me around the track. I had to go up and down. And then puddles. You're fit. Inside, I said, Lord, you missed a chance to get me off the hook. And then they had a booklet. To me, they had a booklet. Had already written my name and stuff. And said, now you line up in front of that office store. When your term is on, he's going to assign you to your unit. And while I was standing, they said, okay, Lord, you have another chance. My inner thoughts, right? You can get me into a unit that doesn't carry a weapon, and then I can get around this too, right? Finally, my term was on. I come in there, and sure enough, he asked me, what unit do you want to go to? I said, oh, Lord, this is a chance. Any unit that doesn't carry a weapon. He says to me, why is that? That takes too long to explain. There's a long line up outside. This is my problem. You tell me why you don't want to go. So I shared my story, my testimony, you could say, right? Took 5-7 minutes, I don't know. When I came out, everybody was looking at me. What took you so long? I envisioned it, right? Then I gave him my story, and then he looked at me and said, young man, this is fascinating. That kind of a spirit we need in the infantry. I said, no, no, I'm not going there. And so we started to haggle there. I said, not going there. You're going there. Stamped in there where I had to show up for basic training and everything. I said, not going there. You will see. I said, yeah, I will see. So I left in disgust. Not only at him. I said, Lord, I'm disappointed. 2 chances you blew, right? A few weeks later, I got to know a young fellow, a bit older than I am. I'd been to a Bible school in Germany, and I was working close to my village where I grew up. And said, he took me out his wings and tried to help me, you know, my Christian life. And he heard about my problems. And I have an answer for your problems. I said, what? You just leave Switzerland. Don't tell anybody and go to that Bible school where I was. You know what? It's good when you read the Bible because you can also read it and, you know, go off the deep end, read some stuff and misinterpret it. It's good to have some guidance. I thought, man, sounds good. But I knew if I tried to go and my parents know about it, they're obligated to tell the government. So I prayed and I said, Lord, okay, I'm going to sign up. See, if they accept me, you know, the Bible's good, then you have to get away to get me out. They accepted me. And then 3 weeks before I had to leave, my dad was a very spontaneous guy. Out of the blue moon comes and said, hey, mom and dad, the youngest sister still at home. We thought we're going to go to Yugoslavia for some holidays. Can you handle it here at home? Oh, I said, yeah! It'll be hard, but I'll try, right? So he left. They left. I started sorting out my clothes, my room, you know, and stuff. Again, spontaneous. 3 days before I had to leave, they show up back home and see this mess. Yeah, what is going on here, right? So I told them, you know, my dad first said, ah, we discussed it, I respect that. But my mom, and she got a hold of herself, she ripped into me. She was such a patriotic Swiss woman. This has nothing to do with your convictions. You're just a coward. You don't want to defend your home country. And so on. Now that you have a profession, just kidding, you know. You don't want to earn money. You want to go to your school. She just ripped me into pieces. And I stood there. And then I said, Mom, I can't prove my motives to you. God knows my heart. Can only hope that you will, you know, see that. She let me go. Didn't say anything to government. But the first year in the Bible school, I didn't hear anything from my mom. Dad would phone, write a letter, send me some money. Mom, silence treatment. Why am I saying this whole story, giving you this whole story? No blind allegiance except to Jesus and his word. Everybody else, you cannot be blindly allegiant. Not to your parents, not to your partner in marriage. No. No blind allegiance is important, do you know? When the state asks blind allegiance, we have to refuse it. We have to refuse it. As I did. As good as I knew. Now coming back to this whole question of taxes. Not only are we today amazed at Jesus' answer, right? But they at that time, it says at the last verse, when they heard this, they were amazed. But the point is this. Jesus doesn't only want to have us be amazed. And that is now the third word. Trap, taxes, t- trade. This text is about a trade on a deeper level, in my opinion. Remember the free trade debate? If you're older, like gray-haired, then you know in the 80s we had this big debate, and Brian Mulroney was the prime minister, about free trade, the benefits and the drawbacks and stuff like that. Trade is also a very a word that can be easily hated or, you know, loved. I love free trade. I buy as much as I can free trade products. Trade can be very good. It's the right thing. When Jesus asks whose image is on the coin, they respond, Caesar's. And he says, then give to Caesar what is Caesar's. But, and now please, listen, whose image were they bearing who asked this question? God's. God's image. We, human beings, are made in his image. And you can bet these guys knew that. Jesus wanted to challenge them to give themselves back to God, to whom they rightfully belonged. Trade themselves in, back into the Creator, people could say. I think this is the deeper meaning here which we need to get. The real problem, therefore, is not whether we should pay or refuse taxes to the oppressor, but the problem is that they refused to give homage, obedience to the one whose image they bore. That is the deepest human problem. They did not want to give themselves back to God, the one who owned them. You could even say, since the fall of man, of humanity, we do not want to give, period. We want to take. That is our nature. We want to take. We specialize in taking. So I want to invite you to hear with the ears of these disciples of the Pharisees and with the Herodians. They needed to hear that their deepest problem was not being under Roman occupation, but being in slavery to sin, in a prisoner to this selfishness which disputes God's ownership of my life. This stubborn pursuit of my own way. They pointed to Roman's oppression as the source of all of their misery. But the real problem is not, and I would even say for today, is never in our circumstances around us, but in the fallen condition within us. That's the ultimate problem. We dispute the Lord's right to guide, to direct us, to be the Lord of our life, even though we bear his image and we rightfully belong to him. And here is the Pharisees' hypocrisy. They usurped God's authority, similar to the Romans, and imposed their will on God. When we, as humans, we usurped God's authority, we tried to impose our will on God. All of us tend to do that by nature. We want to remake him in our own image. We want to remake God in our own image. The nature of idolatry. The Pharisees were blaming Rome for something they were equally guilty of doing in their relationship to God. They complained about Rome coming in and imposing their will. But that's what they had done in relationship to God. If these men would only give themselves back to him, then the kingdom of God would be truly established or re-established in and among them, as Luke 17 says. The kingdom of God does not come without outward appearances. It is within you. That's when it happens, that God gets a new supremacy. Now, I have the suspicion, to be honest, that is why God allowed them to experience and suffer the consequences
of the behavior towards God at the hands of the Romans. Can I say that again? I have the suspicion that God let these folks, the people at that time, experience the consequences of behavior towards God at the hands of the Romans. The treatment they received from their oppressors was to sober them out so it would dawn on them how they had treated their Creator, how they had treated God. Now let me quickly come to an end. In a similar way, at times God allows difficulties and sufferings in our life to cause us to see reality again as He ordered and defined it, rather than us being able to keep on going and manipulate, reshape reality so it serves us, our selfish interests. The only option, in a sense, is to allow God to shape me so I fit into reality. You cannot shape reality so it suits you. Never, nobody can. And yet we keep on trying, stubbornly. Giving ourselves back to God, on one hand, needs to happen once, existentially, as I understand it, in a genuine conversion experience, when I'm willing to turn myself back in, trade myself back in, and make Jesus Lord of my heart and life. But it needs to continue on a continuous basis, daily, leaving my life in God's hands. Not daring to usurp again, but daily reaffirm that He is Lord and I want to follow Him rather than trying to dictate. When Jesus is allowed to dominate me on an ongoing basis, then circumstances will not be able to dominate me and make me miserable when they are miserable. Ultimately, it is not circumstances which we can blame, but we have to look at ourselves. If life is difficult, in a sense, the inward balance is missing. If circumstances have a domineering impact on you, make you miserable and you complain easily, then you give away that you have not made or not stayed with that commitment to the Lord. I'm deeply convinced about that. Deeply convinced about that. May God, through His Spirit, stir us to be people who have understood, as we trade ourselves back to Him, life will be lifted from our inner wholeness of being in sync again with the Creator, and therefore in sync with reality as He instituted it. Thanks for your patience. I'm looking forward to some interaction and discussion.